You're listening to the Ask Drone You podcast. You ask, we answer your drone questions. Whether you're here to turn your passion into profit or you simply fly for fun, we're a community of learners and teachers who aspire to achieve greatness. We are
Drone You.
Hey everyone, and welcome to another fantastic episode of Ask Drone You. My name is Paul, and I'm flying solo today to give you an update on the FAA Symposium Conference and so much more. Thanks again for being with me, guys. I really do appreciate it. Really do appreciate everyone who believes in our message, believes in what we're trying to do, and helps spread that message. If you want to give some social currency to Drone You, you can become a member at thedroneyou.com or droneyou.education. And if you want to really help us out, again, with that social currency, leave us a review on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you download shows. You can also subscribe and get these shows automatically on your phone to keep up to date on what's going on in the drone world. All right. So again, Rob is not here. He is in Denver enjoying his love life with his pretty wife. And I am here trying to get ready to go to a training off in Florida. But anyway, I wanted to get back into the FAA Symposium. In yesterday's podcast, we talked significantly about remote ID, UTM, major themes, you know, 336, the whole hobbyist stuff going out the window. Now, I don't think that's really scaring a lot of hobbyists if you want to know the truth. After I posted the article, again, that article is on our Facebook page, facebook.com/droneyou. You can read the whole organized bit on the whole FAA Symposium. But when I posted about hobbyist stuff in Rotor Riot's group, no one seemed to care, which I thought was really, really interesting. So today we're going to be talking about the next talk that I attended, which was Beyond Visual Line of Sight Waivers. Now, I don't know if you're like me, but if you're like me, you realize that drones can offer a significant value to a lot of clients, but that we are really limited in the scope of value that we can provide to certain customers. And I give the example of, you know, with photogrammetry and LiDAR, there are some really good uses of LiDAR. The fact that you can see very finite particles like power lines very easily. You can scan large areas much faster than photogrammetry. And overall, you can get very great, very, very good slash great data without nearly the amount of time as photogrammetry. The only issue is the models rarely look lifelike. And with a lot of LiDAR users lack an understanding of photogrammetry, the lifelike nature of their models can really suffer as well, because oftentimes what these guys do with LiDAR is they just shoot their LiDAR and then do a crosshatching 90-degree nadir mission and then overlay the mesh on top of their LiDAR, and it doesn't always add up correctly. Now, with photogrammetry, we can get really lifelike-looking models utilizing multiple acquisition strategies to get incredible data, but it takes a lot more time than LiDAR. Chances are, with photogrammetry, it's really going to be difficult to get over, say, 400 acres in a day. With LiDAR, you don't have to fly the same cross-hatching missions. You don't have to fly oblique missions. You just fly and scan, and it's normally pretty simple. Now, you can cover a lot more ground with LiDAR. You can cover that same 400 acres in maybe an hour and a half compared to 8 hours of flying, say, a Phantom. But here's the thing. When you're flying LiDAR, a lot of big government contracts and forest service contracts come into play. Things like vegetation analysis, bare earth models, updated topographical maps, updated erosion models, and so much more. Now, the benefit of using drones in LiDAR is the fact that we can fly lower, fly slower, and get more accurate data than something like a helicopter or a plane. So the added benefit of flying LiDAR from a drone is that, number one, better data, and number two, not only is our data better, but we can use ground control points to really measure the overall accuracy, which is going to be difficult when you're in a plane. So that being said, we can get more complete data with drones. But when we're trying to do these big, larger contracts, oftentimes, drones can't compete because of the sheer volume of size. For example, in one government contract with NOAA, there's over, I think it's 17 million acres of land essentially to be mapped and have aerial photography completed on this area. This area is for erosion control, and it's all along the eastern seaboard. But as of the law, how it stands right now, there's really no way for a drone operator to compete. as the contract has a given lifespan. It can only be done in a certain amount of time. And given that time, it's almost impossible for any drone pilot or team of drone pilots to get the data in the recommended time. But here's the thing. The level of data that NOAA is asking for is almost not possible with a helicopter or a plane. So where does this leave us? This leaves us with beyond visual line of sight operations. Even if a pilot could fly a LiDAR unit on, say, a Pulse helicopter and fly 1 mile away, that would add a significant amount of space that he could fly his drone and get a lot more work done. As of right now, drones are only allowed to stay, visual line of sight. So what is that? 2,250 feet if you have maybe 20/20 vision. If we could even take that up to a mile in radius from any position, the sheer numbers and the scalability increases dramatically. This is why beyond visual line of sight operations are so imperative. Without even talking about things like BNSF railroads, things like drone delivery with Amazon, things like UPS delivery with Amazon flying beyond visual line of sight, the next gateway in the drone market is really beyond visual line of sight operations, because it's where all the major carriers, it's where the UPS, the Boeings, the Airbuses, the Amazons, the Google Wing, this is where all those projects take flight. Without BVLOS, the next industrial evolution in the market is on hold. Now, that being said, I was really excited to attend the BVLOS waiver panel that was going on at FAA. They said that they were going to be talking about how BNSF, how FLIR got their waivers to fly beyond visual line of sight. And what I was really trying to do was focus on what were the KPIs, what were the key performance indicators that gave the FAA, these two companies or individuals, the ability to fly BVLOS? Because in a lot of the BVLOS waivers, I've noticed that there's still the need for visual observers, which I don't really understand. Why do you need a visual observer? So let's say you can fly a mile, but you're supposed to have a visual observer daisy chained, which is what one waiver was essentially saying. How is that a benefit when, again, a helicopter can go in and do this operation, which is much more dangerous for a helicopter to be doing? But the reason the company chooses to go the helicopter route is because the drone team needs 5 people and the helicopter team needs 2. So is it really financially efficient? Probably not. Now, with BVLOS, I wanted to know, okay, so were there any waivers without visual observers? What was the max distance? Because right now, Vic and I are trying to figure out, is there a way that we can systematize BVLOS waivers for the FAA to make it critical, streamlined, easy? If it's done in a certain airspace, it's done with a certain radius, it's done with a certain visual observer or not, it's done with a particular... A particular operation, for example. These are all things that I was trying to figure out, and really in with Vic's help, to see if maybe we could systematize BVLOS waivers for the FAA. Now, there are two issues with having BNSF Railroad and FLIR presenting during the BVLOS panel. Number one, FLIR purchased a company that had already acquired those waivers, and then FLIR acquired those waivers. So you have a guy up there talking about all the work that they did to get these waivers when someone else did that work and they purchased the company. And you could tell, too, when he was kind of like making crap up, to say the least. Now, with BNSF Railroads, they let out a couple of details that everyone started looking around the room like, is this really going on right now? Number one, all of the BVLOS operations by BNSF Railroad are done with drones over 55 pounds. So Part 107 has to be waived in the fact that the limitation of 55 pounds. That's part number one. Part number two, every single BNSF Railroad pilot that operates those drones, BVLOS, has a Part 61 instrument rating. That means that they are a full-blown Cessna or helicopter pilot with an instrument rating, meaning they can fly in poor weather and use only their instruments to be able to fly the vehicle. Now, that being said, the fact that they had to do that almost negates the entire point of beyond visual line of sight operations. If someone has to pay, say, $10,000, $20,000, $30,000 to go get an instrument rating, what's the point of having a drone program? It really doesn't make sense. I understand the BNSF was part of the Pathfinder program, where the FAA could gather and collect data on BVLOS operations in order to make a collective decision on a system to give BVLOS waivers out. That's great. But why didn't we test regular Part 107 pilots' ability to fly these beyond visual line of sight operations? Then we would have data on how much extra training would someone really need from Part 107 up. Could we have a Part 107 instrumentation rating? Is that something that would come? Is that data and answers that we would get from these operations to give us that answer? In addition to that, it just made everyone think like, wow, I mean, like, it's not really a beyond visual line of sight waiver because it's not even a Part 107 pilot doing it. It's a Part 61 pilot. And they're flying drones over 55 pounds, so that makes the waiver even more complex. In addition, the amount of infrastructure that BNSF Railroad has built up to service these drones is substantial. So I'm not really sure it's the best test case for people trying to get BVLOS operations. Although I think it is a great test case for people like Amazon who want to actually be delivering packages to homes all over, which in one of the presentations, Project Wing actually showcased the fact that they have done many successful deliveries already, and they're gathering significant data to present to the FAA. But with only two BVLOS waivers being presented on the panel and these tidbits of information, everyone is shaking their head being like, wow, we are so far away from a system of getting BVLOS waivers. Well, luckily, on accident, I ran into the FAA's, forget his first name, but Mr. Grogan, and asked him, I said, so is there even a system for these waivers yet? Because this is getting a little ridiculous. And he's like, well, no, there it is conceptually there, but we don't have a system just yet. So everyone needs to hold on. So I would say that my optimism of seeing a system for BVLOS waivers and other complex operational waivers completely died and went out the window when I went to this conference, as I realized I'm not going to get an instrument rating, number one. Number two, you know, the radius for FLIR is only a mile. And in addition, a lot of these people are not getting waivers really ever. So the FAA did have during their luncheon a discussion on how many waivers have been given out over what period of time. They say that the average waiver or authorization being given out was 29 days. But now here's my question. In the same talk, they gave out that number, 29 days is the average, right? But then 5 minutes later, they said, okay, now we're not going to be talking about authorizations for this entire panel. We're going to be talking about waivers. They made a big point to showcase the difference between airspace authorizations and waivers and what is covered under waivers, what is not. So my question on the whole 29 days of an average time frame to get one of these quote-unquote waivers is, was that data included with the airspace authorizations or not? Because the other data showcasing how many waivers have not been given out and how many have would dictate a much longer period of time in order to actually get one of these operational waivers. So very, very interesting tactics by the FAA, if not brilliant, in all honesty. But we really need BVLOS to open up for more smaller operations, for more engineers, for more surveyors to really be able to utilize this technology and do more with it. And it seems like the FAA is really dragging their feet with BVLOS. And it just makes you wonder, like, is it a lack of funding? Do they need more people? I would say yes to both of those things. But in addition, it seems like they need to have some program that's completely new and dedicated towards getting a system made for these waivers and pushing them through. Because at what point in time does the FAA impede commerce? At what point in time does the FAA's lack to make a timely and succinct decision on waivers become an impedance of commerce and thus an act against the Sherman Act or a violation of the Sherman Act? If you're not sure what the Sherman Act is, I would definitely check it out. I think it's something that's worth thinking about. It's a violation that's really helped me in my previous businesses, and it's something that could help you. It's all about monopolies and creating anything that could get in the way of commerce, essentially. So the fact that we haven't seen a lawsuit noting the Sherman Act against the FAA, I find interesting. I think a lawsuit may speed things up, but I also am worried now because there's a lot of these new bills coming out, like from like Feinstein's federalism bill, that would just really throw a wrench in this whole timeline of the FAA trying to figure out how to do these waivers better. Those things worry me. I really want the FAA to figure this out. I think they did a really fantastic job with Part 107. We just need the follow-up to get these waivers out to people because we are really slowing the industry down. And the other thing is, you worry, right? You know, if it takes years for BNSF to get a beyond visual line of sight waiver, and they're still really not even conducting the missions that are pertaining to their business, they're really just acquiring data, they're researching this, they're figuring out what works and what doesn't. How would a small business, a startup, try to offer a service with their drone that needed BVLOS and couldn't wait 2 years because of funding? That's why you could be seeing more and more businesses going out of business until the FAA comes up with some sort of system that can get a business, you know, granted in say 3 months or 6 months from startup. Because otherwise, I mean, that's why I think these big businesses are being listened to by the FAA. They have the money. And more importantly, they have the money to have the time to be patient to get answers, even if the answers suck. And I give the example of CNN. They had an entire talk on their flight over people waiver. Their drone has to be tethered. They got a total of 21 feet of elevation. It took them 2 years and almost $300,000 to be able to get this waiver. Is that really worth it? Probably not. But let me ask you the question this way. Is it worth it if the industry benefits as a whole to that waiver and providing a new reasonable system of acquiring waivers? Well, yes. But then the next question is, why is CNN paying for it? Shouldn't we already have that system in place? Isn't that something that they should be working on their own? I think it just goes to show that they are very short-staffed. They're very understaffed. As you guys can see, there's been a lot of information that has really come out of this symposium. And overall, I'm happy again that the FAA's attitude is one to be open to what people have to say, but we have simply got to move faster. This is almost ridiculous. Again, businesses could literally crash as soon as they take to the skies because of this this really unnavigable path of getting waivers. There is no system. There is no defined set of rules. It is really, does this operation provide safety and make me feel good? Is kind of really where it's at right now. You know, the FAA talks about having performance-based standards in your waivers, saying to us, you have to show us how you're going to be safe. You have to show us how you're going to mitigate risks, and you have to show us how you're going to maintain the smallest amount of risk possible. Yes, but as long as we are doing these waivers to make individual inspectors feel good, we are a long way away from being in a world and a system where drones can really augment existing businesses and really provide a means to a problem that exists all out in the world right now. So, you know, with that being said, I will say, though, I think that we are still in the infancy of this market. There are going to be a lot more drones coming down the line later and later. They're going to become more and more and more prevalent. I feel like we're in the early 90s of cell phones right now when it comes to drones. People are still learning how they can be used for good. They're still learning how they can be used for their business. And on top of that, these businesses, once they get to that point, are now saying, how do I navigate this rat hole of legislation? How do I get what I need to get and become profitable quickly? So once the FAA can get these concepts turned into systems, we're going to be really in great shape. That could be in 2 to 3 years. But that also goes to show that you as a drone pilot, if you stay up to date on all this regulatory information, you can really provide significant value to companies who are trying to build up drones in their business. So Anyway, I think that's going to do it for today's show, brought to you by the DroneU community. If you're not a part of the DroneU community and want access to over 28, that's right, there is a new class in there right now, 28 new classes, then you are going to want to check out DroneU.education. Just go right now to DroneU.education to sign up. Thanks again for listening, guys. If you have a question, go to AskDroneU.com. I know these two shows have been a little bit unusual as we normally have questions, but people have been asking so many questions in the community. And again, if you want to check out the article that goes along with this podcast and yesterday's, make sure to go to our Facebook page, facebook.com/DroneU, and check out our most recent article, which was posted on the DroneU webpage. That's going to do it for me today, guys. My name is Paul, and you're listening to Ask DroneU.
We believe that videos, images, words, and sounds have the absolute power to inform, inspire, and entertain. We reject indecision, confusion, and vanity, for they work against the community. We are united under the virtues of safety and knowledge. We are a training community of learners and teachers who encourage and energize each other to achieve greatness. We are pilots, videographers, photographers, freelancers, business owners, enthusiasts, experts, and apprentices. We are creators. We are the DroneU.